From WHYY in rainy Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet producer, writer, and storyteller David Brown. He produced Jaws, Cocoon, and The Sting. Also, he writes the titillating blurbs on the cover of Cosmopolitan magazine, which helps sell the magazine his wife, Helen Gurley Brown, edits. Also today, reporter Timothy Egan on the Pacific Northwest, a land where newcomers throughout the past 200 years have always caused problems. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead is back with more of the music of Duke Ellington, and the new autumn harvest of TV shows is a gathering in the electronic cube. Television critic David Bianculli tunes into two of them. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. An Iraqi freighter is heading to Jordan with 17 armored bridge layers. The devices enable tanks to cross difficult terrain and are considered offensive, not defensive weapons. News of the shipment was released today by Jane's Defense Weekly, a British publication that covers the defense industry. The publication says Iraq received 7 of the bridge layers in a deal last year with the former communist East German government. 17 more are reported to have left Poland on July 31st en route for the Jordanian port of Aqaba. The ship's location is said to be unknown. Meanwhile, Iraq warned its own citizens today that anyone harboring Western foreigners would face grave penalties. That warning came as the U.S. State Department confirmed 12 Americans were moved from hotels in Kuwait. The Iraqis are using thousands of Western foreigners as a shield against attack. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Dubai.
The harsh Iraqi order today may be a small sign that there are Iraqi citizens willing to protect foreigners. Nevertheless, the transfer of Americans to strategic sites inside Iraq continued today. A French report said Americans were housed in mobile homes around an electrical plant near the Iraqi capital. In another development, Iraq ordered all foreign embassies in Kuwait to close in 5 days, adding more risk to those who assault shelter there. After the deadline, Iraq threatened to round up diplomatic personnel and cancel their diplomatic immunity. The U.S. government advised Americans in Jordan to leave the country today. While there's been no specific threat in Jordan, much of the population there backs the Iraqi leader. In Dubai, this is Deborah Amos.
For the first time today, President Bush used the term hostage to describe the Americans and other foreign nationals being held in Iraq and Kuwait. NPR's Koki Roberts has a report on the president's speech this morning to the veterans of foreign wars.
After days of administration refusal to refer to the thousands of Americans held in Kuwait as hostages, President Bush said today they are, in fact, hostages. By describing them as such, the president raises the ante in the confrontation in the Persian Gulf, since he has said all along that protecting the safety of U.S. citizens is one of the primary reasons for sending thousands of troops to the region. The president reiterated his other goals today, the removal of Iraqi troops from Kuwait, the restoration of the legitimate government of Kuwait, and the protection of Saudi Arabia. But the realization of those goals seems less likely today than it did 18 days ago when the president deployed troops, and Iraq's holding of thousands of American civilians will further complicate the president's policy options. I'm Koki Roberts in Washington.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 12 points to close the day at 2656.44. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-2 in light trading of 130 million shares. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson. That great white shark kept people out of the water all summer long in 1975. And even when audiences knew the shark was fake, millions flocked to the movie Jaws and made millions for the makers and the reputation of then-27-year-old director Steven Spielberg. One of the producers of Jaws, David Brown, is my guest today. Brown teamed with Richard Zanuck in the 70s to produce not only Jaws, but many of other successful Hollywood films, including The Sting, The Verdict, and Cocoon. He now has his own production company, The Manhattan Project. Brown, now 73, is also an editor. He worked for Cosmopolitan magazine in the 40s and to this day writes the cover blurbs for the magazine his wife, Helen Gurley Brown, edits. Brown's most recent project is a series of films for HBO called Women and Men, Stories of Seduction. The stories are by Mary McCarthy, Dorothy Parker, and Ernest Hemingway. These are quintessential American stories, but two of the three were filmed in England. I asked David Brown why.
Well, the reason we filmed two of them in England was that we had to create a 1936 railroad train compartment corridor. And while it may seem to most listeners that all we had to do was go out into some railroad graveyard and exhume an old train, it doesn't work that way. You have to have breakaway walls, you have to film in the compartment but be able to get outside the compartment and all of that. And we also had the services of a world-class production designer, a man named John Graysmark, whose credits range from Lawrence of Arabia to Ragtime, and who was able with research to duplicate not only a train going across the United States in the 1930s, but a early 1930s Manhattan apartment. And it was less expensive and far better for us to shoot on a stage at Shepperton Studios outside London than to actually get a New York apartment and muffle the noise and go through all of that.
The stories all had that sort of masterpiece theater lushness, sort of a completeness of look and authenticity that somehow I think we associate with British productions more so than American productions.
I think that's true. And I think that first of all, the sets that we built were not built for television. They were really built for features. Even though we shot these films in 6 days, the sets were meant to last for the ages, particularly the apartment set in the Dorothy Parker Dusk Before Fireworks. These are remarkable sets. The wardrobe, everything about it was the best feature standard. I might say the best British feature standard, and yet American in subject matter. And as for the Hemingway story, obviously that took place in Spain, and we shot it in Spain.
As producer of these series, how involved were you in selecting the actors and actresses?
Well, very much as a supplicant. The first comes the director, but except in one instance, we cast it first. Bill Gilmore and I produced these films. Bill Gilmore and I have been together since Jaws. He's a very experienced line production man. And we and the directors really had a consensus on the actors we would approach. Oddly enough, James Woods is a Hemingway scholar, and we approached him. And he was fascinated, liked the idea of Tony Richardson very much, and met Melanie Griffith at a car wash and said, "Hey, how would you like to work in Spain for a week? I've got a Hemingway story." And she said, "Fine."
That sounds like a quintessential Hollywood story.
Yes, it's true, too.
Meeting at the car wash.
Yes.
The story of the shark in Jaws is, of course, legendary, whether or not people would actually come to a movie and see a shark that people knew was fake. Did this cause you trepidation when you were testing the film?
Oh, anguish, of course. There was no guarantee until the film was viewed by paying audience that anyone would be taken in with it. It was reassuring when we showed Jaws to our cast and crew who had been there and heard the groaning of the hydraulic pumps and saw the cables and demonstrably were working with an artificial fish. When they were jumping out of their seats, we thought we had them. And it turned out that the civilian audience was equally terrified. But to have the actual crew of a film were there, terrified by their own creation, was very comforting.
The film made phenomenal amounts of money for you and other people involved in the project and for the 27-year-old Steven Spielberg. What kind of freedom did this give you? Did you feel you could go out then and do anything you wanted, or did you find when you came time to make another film, you were right back where you started as a producer pitching a project to the studios?
Richard Zanuck and I were partners for years and produced that film and many others. And the big catch is it doesn't change anything. You get some money, yes, and get some economic freedom, but it doesn't change the feeling of angst, anxiety, humiliation, the ability to suffer from bad reviews and to be hurt and humiliated and all the rest. No, the catch was we had to keep working, and it didn't really help us get anything else on. It did help Steven Spielberg. We put him into the Nuclear Club of Film Directors, and Steven was able, because he is the filmmaker, and there's no question, I don't think films are necessarily a director's medium. It is the director who assures the fact that the film is going to be made, because no actor has ever committed to a producer, always to a director.
You said that you don't think a film is a director's medium. Do you think it's anyone's medium?
I think that's a very astute... I don't think it's anyone's medium. I think it's a big mix, particularly in this country where there are very few auteurs, perhaps, no question about it, Woody Allen and Steven Spielberg. But for the most part, it's a collaborative effort, and the director is helpless without the cast, etc. The writer is, the script is everything. It attracts the director and the actors. The producer has to attract the money and the director and the writers and have the initial vision of what to make. So my feeling is that feature movies are not anybody's medium. They're everybody's medium, including the public's.
You were at one time a drama critic for Women's Wear Daily in your early days, just out of school. How did you make the jump from there into movies?
I was getting a divorce. I had really very little interest in films. Films were not in the 40s and 50s quite what they are today. They were considered a form of selling out. You really wanted to stay behind and write the book and write the play. But I was getting a divorce, and I wanted to change my life, and one of the reigning moguls of the period, Daryl F. Zanuck, had this notion that a major studio should be operated like a national magazine with an editor-in-chief. And since I had been editor of Cosmopolitan light years before I met my wife, Helen Gurley Brown, who's piloted it much more successfully, he chose me, and it was a propitious time for me to go west and get away from the agony of my personal life.
And what was the first movie you produced?
Well, Daryl, Dick Zanuck and I formed our production company in 1972, but when I joined Daryl F. Zanuck as executive in charge of what were euphemistically called creative operations, we made all the movies at the studio. These producers were kind of surrogates of the boss. That was Daryl F. Zanuck. So I was working with directors, producers, and I can't take credit for any movie, but I was involved with such films as The Robe, one of the many that saved 20th Century Fox periodically. It was always a picture that saved the studio. And films like Love is a Many Splendid Thing, Richard Zanuck and I, running 20th Century Fox, Dick in charge, were responsible for Patton, MASH, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and numerous films of lesser stature. And I'm afraid I was responsible for Cleopatra.
Cleopatra was one of the first movies that set the trend for excessive production overruns in Hollywood, and it was as much notorious for that as the love affair going on between Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor at the time. How have you seen producers' treatment of stars? How have you changed your treatment of stars from the days of Elizabeth Taylor and Cleopatra to working with people such as Paul Newman in The Verdict?
I've never changed my treatment of stars, but not having been the producer of the films I've mentioned, but one of the executives in charge of production, as Dick was the president of the company, I was executive vice president, we were always very, if anything, obsequious. Stars are to be treated very carefully. Stars have changed and companies have changed in that professionalism has taken over to a larger degree as the economic stakes grew larger. It was very difficult to deal with an actor who would not show up. But I haven't changed, and I pride myself on my relationship with stars and non-stars.
My guest is David Brown, the producer whose films include Jaws, The Sting, The Verdict, and Cocoon. I know that a day in the life of a producer is not typical in any way, but I wonder if you could take us through, a day in Martha's Vineyard shooting Jaws.
For the producer's life on a well-run movie is quite simple. He gets up later than the crew, as a rule, and then he goes over to the production office and see what catastrophes or calamities have accumulated during the night, who didn't show up, or who's sick, all that sort of thing. Then he wanders over, or it could be she, wanders over to the set and makes the ceremonial call on the director, doesn't hang around behind the camera, but finds out usually first from the guys on the set how everything is going. He sneaks over to the script supervisor and sort of tries to find out how many shots we've gotten. When was the first shot? Was it at 8:50? Bravo. And are there any special problems? Then when the director is not distracted by directing, he goes over and sees if there's anything he can do. Are the box lunches good? Has there been any problem? We are the buffers between the front office, the studio, and the company on the location. And we have to be double agents. We have to represent the money, so to speak, the financiers, and we have to have the full confidence of our actors, director, and crew.
You describe the need to do sometimes surreptitious shots, shots that are not storyboarded and approved by the studio, but you feel you need to do actually on the scene. What role do you take in that?
Well, the role of complicity. Generally speaking, the studio that puts up the money wants to know everything that's going to be photographed and wants an explanation for anything that hasn't been planned. And so one, as the producer, you hide things, particularly on a film like Jaws. You play along with the director and the artists in getting those extra shots. And the role that the producer plays is being responsible and at times irresponsible.
How irresponsible?
Well, sometimes you have to side with the inmates, so to speak, and make certain... The studio will never understand the problems on the set. It's impossible. One wonderful thing about Universal Studios during that period is that their production heads, physical production heads, had actually worked as production managers. Many such people in those jobs do. And they knew pretty well what was going on. And there's no use explaining why it's taking so long to get a shot or why there are 30 or 40 takes. Sometimes we don't understand it ourselves. But the role of the producer is to do everything to expedite, but at the same time not in any way vitiate the artistic effort.
The accounting system of Hollywood has been called to task in recent months, and it seems that the larger the expenditure on a movie and the larger the take, the less money is made. I wonder how you react to charges about the accounting system in Hollywood.
Well, usually with an audit. Uh-huh. I don't think any film that we've ever made, Mr. Zanuck and I, hasn't been audited. My only question to the auditors has always been, is there a possibility that you might find that we had received more money than we should have received as a result of your audit? And he said, this has never occurred in Hollywood history. The fact is that those motion picture contracts spell out all the expenses, and grown men draw those contracts and read them. High-priced lawyers vet them. And generally speaking, it's not dishonesty at all. It's a very arcane subject, very complicated, and deliberately so.
My guest today is David Brown, film producer. His films include Jaws, The Sting, The Verdict, Cocoon, and he also, with his wife Helen Gurley Brown, helped shape the Cosmopolitan magazine that we know today. His new book is called Let Me Entertain You. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film producer David Brown. Your wife is Helen Gurley Brown, renowned as the editor of Cosmopolitan magazine, a magazine that you edited sometime before you met her. But you also had an earlier association with her in a professional capacity, helping her plan and write Sex and the Single Girl, probably one of the most phenomenal books that sort of turned the corner for the 60s. How did that association come about?
Helen and I lived in Los Angeles, actually in Pacific Palisades, California, and I was thrown out of work by this ill-advised idea I had of having the studio make Cleopatra, having no idea that it would leave more ruins, more sets around Europe than the Romans did. And the Helen was unhappy in her advertising career. She was a copywriter for an agency there. And she was thinking of something to write. And I said, why don't you write How to Have an Affair? Because Helen and I were not very young when we married. She was 37. And she said, that's a good idea. And then that evolved into what was called Sex for the Single Girl. And the first publisher who saw it was too shocked, thought that it could never be written in the first person. So we got the manuscript back, and then Random House, through Bernard Geist, took it on, permitted it to go out as a first-person story by Helen Gurley Brown, but changed the title to Sex and the Single Girl. Sex for the Single Girl was considered too explicit. Single girls were not supposed to have sex. And in flogging the book on television and radio in those days, it was never permitted to mention the title during the day. When she was on the Today Show interviewed by Cleveland Amory, they had to talk about that book, about single women. Late at night, the title was perfectly acceptable. I remember doing a show in San Francisco, having her doing a show at the Hungry Eye, and it was perfectly all right. It was after midnight, and the title could be mentioned when all good little boys and girls had gone to bed.
But it was no Sex in the Single Girl before breakfast, clearly.
Clearly not.
So from the book, her reputation was established. She went on to write a column called Step Into My Parlor. How did you then make the connection with the idea of doing a magazine?
Well, the first thing is, it made her famous, but it also made her notorious. Hmm. We received letters from our respective parents virtually writing us out of their wills. I mean, how could we do this? How could we disgrace the family and all of that sort of thing? The column she wrote was actually called Woman Alone, and it was Step Into My Parlor being the column she now writes for the magazine itself.
Oh, right, yeah.
And the connection, there was so much. First of all, when 20th Century Fox closed down and I was let go along with 5,000 others, moved back to New York, I became a book publisher, and Helen continued to write books, and we had this notion, having received a lot of mail from not only Sex and the Single Girl, but Sex and the Office and the column, that there was a constituency out there for her kind of writing and her ideas. And so we did a dummy that is a prototype of a magazine in our kitchen. We pasted it up with the kind of ads that we thought such a magazine would run. And I took it around to various publishers until I found the Hearst Corporation was about to extinguish their nearly 100-year-old magazine, Cosmopolitan, which was a magazine for men and women. And they took a shot with it. They thought it was a good idea, but they gave Mrs. Brown a contract with the provision that should it not work out in 6 months, they would take over her column and she could work off the rest of her contract as a writer for their newspapers. But at the same time, they showed considerable courage. Richard E. Deems was then head of the magazine division, and he said, let's do it. And Helen had never edited a magazine. She was terrified. She was catatonic. She was in tears. She didn't know what to do. And I said, well, anytime you get in a problem, call me and we'll talk about it. My office was a block away at the 20th Century Fox headquarters in New York, and she'd call me. We'd get into a taxi. She'd bring me a sheaf of manuscripts and art things, and we'd go over everything in a cab. That was after she said, I cannot tell the staff that I'm thinking about it any longer. I must make a decision. So off we went, rolling around Central Park in a taxi, going over. Well, I must tell you, within a year, she was weaned, because my career at Cosmopolitan was a disaster. We couldn't even get our magazine sold with the likes of Ernest Hemingway, whose novel we published. It was very tough. The general magazines were not succeeding because the beginning of television was taking the advertising away from magazines of that kind.
You still write the cover blurbs for Cosmopolitan that you did for many years?
As recently as this morning.
What will be on the next issue?
Well, I'm working on a cover blurb about Richard Dreyfuss now, and I'm also just wrote a cover blurb about how ex-wives can not be boring, but be seductive and drive their former husbands crazy. And I've also another cover blurb I've written. This sounds very low class for your very high class program. But
oh, don't count on it.
But I did write one and say how to negotiate sex with your husband on your terms. And we also do a few higher level blurbs, but at the moment I can't think of one.
There was an early blurb for a Cosmopolitan shortly after your wife took it over, pertaining to an article on the pill, on the birth control pill. But for some reason it was too risque for the cover. What was it, and did it eventually ever get into the magazine?
Oh, yes. It was the first. It was about estrogen, actually. It was the first article. And I wrote a blurb, say, the pill that makes women more responsive to men. And the management that time, and for the only time, complained, said, this cannot go. It's just too suggestive. So I suggested that we take out to men. And it flew without that as how to make the pill that makes women more responsive, which I felt was even more salacious than the first one in terms of that particular time in history. The pill that makes women more responsive sold out the magazine. Women wanted to be more responsive, and that was an era in which pills were supposed to do everything.
I'm struck by the range of work that you've done, working in publishing, working in the movies. What instinct do you feel that you have that allows you to excel in these fields?
Excel or fail, and I'm not being humble because both come together. The reason I'm in the legitimate theater, which I entered late in my life, and I'm writing books and television, which I entered late in life, and movies, is that they all connect somehow to my early days in journalism when I was a newspaper reporter. Actually, going back before that, when I was an astrologer, I actually wrote horoscopes for vending machines in New York subways, the only way to make a living in the Depression era. And it was a great job because I never advised anybody to do anything dangerous.
How much do you know about astrology?
Nothing. I cribbed everything from the astrology magazines, and short of an interview with Zoroaster, I couldn't think of anyone who could do it any better, and I do have some respect for it. By the way, astrology is just soaring these days. I guess people can't find out answers any other way, and also they figure there might be something to it, although some of the newer stars have not been included in the zodiac. But to answer your question, everything that I do is connected with the written word, even though it may be broadcast or put on film or on tape. It all goes back to the days at Stanford University in Columbia when I was a journalism student and when I was taken up by the idea of writing.
One last question here. I'm always struck by photographs I see of producers, including you, with cigars.
Mm.
And what is it with producers and big cigars?
Oh, I don't think there's another producer anywhere except me who still smokes cigars. When I was early in the business, first of all, nobody will let them smoke cigars. And they're all on health kicks. They're all jogging and carrying Evian bottles around and eating and drinking herb tea. I'm still drinking scotches. And when I can get a good Cuban cigar, I smoke it. But first question I asked Helen Gurley when we decided to get married was, how do you feel about cigars? And she said, I rather like them. And that sealed the whole thing, as far as I was concerned. The cigar-smoking producer is a stereotype of the 30s and 40s. I'm really a dinosaur in that respect.
Well, David Brown, thank you very much for being a guest on Fresh Air with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
My guest today, David Brown. He's the producer of the film trilogy Women and Men, Stories of Seduction. The stories are being shown through August on HBO. His account of his producer's life is in his new book, Let Me Entertain You. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, physicist Arno Penzias. In 1978, he won the Nobel Prize for his radio astronomy work that supported the Big Bang Theory. His latest book, Ideas and Information, is a guide to the new information technology. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. Today, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead samples some newly available Duke Ellington music. Also, for many people in the country, the Pacific Northwest represents a distant fantasy, a vacation place, a place they see on TV in series such as Twin Peaks, a place they'd perhaps rather live. Coming up, reporter Timothy Egan tells us about struggles newcomers and less than newcomers alike have encountered over the past 150 years in the Pacific Northwest. And television critic David Bianculli plucks two new shows to examine from NBC's Autumnal Plumage. That's all coming up next on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. For the first time, President Bush is describing the more than 3,000 Americans trapped in Iraq and Kuwait as hostages, as 12 more Americans cannot be accounted for. Barry Schwide reports.
Bush attached the label hostage to the Americans after the White House had rejected a proposal by Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. It offered to free the Americans if the U.S. withdraws its forces from the Persian Gulf. That unacceptable proposal underscored how diplomacy isn't working. So, U.S. Reserve gave way to use of the hostage description. 35 Americans who disappeared last week from a hotel in Baghdad still are unaccounted for. And today, the State Department said at least a dozen other Americans had been removed from three hotels in Kuwait City. Again, their whereabouts unknown. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
In New York City at the UN, the Security Council has scheduled an emergency meeting tonight on a U.S. plan to put a UN seal of approval on naval actions to enforce UN sanctions against Iraq. It is not certain that these talks will lead to a formal meeting on proposals by the U.S. to get Council approval for military activities in the Persian Gulf without putting national troops under a UN command or having the world body authorize a blockade. NPR's John Idstey traveled to a major border crossing on the Saudi-Kuwait border today, and he found the Saudi side only lightly guarded as a few refugees continued to move through.
Kuwaiti refugees and a few Westerners and other foreigners continue to move through this Saudi outpost on the Kuwait-Saudi border near the Persian Gulf. Even now, tired Kuwaitis, some sitting in the sun, others in the sparse shade provided by small trees and shrubs, wait for the papers needed to travel further into Saudi Arabia. Across the desert is the Kuwaiti outpost, now occupied by Iraqis. Saudi officials point to dark objects spaced across the desert flanking that outpost. They say they are Iraqi tanks. But most of the Iraqi troops are at least 25 miles from here, dug in defensive perimeters, according to Saudi officials. I'm John Idstey, reporting from the Kuwait-Saudi border.
OPEC has announced that it will not call an emergency meeting to consider increasing oil production to make up for the shortfall caused by the Persian Gulf crisis. Saudi Arabia, which has said it plans to increase oil production, had called for the meeting. But a brief statement issued by OPEC headquarters in Vienna said today that there was not enough support for such a meeting. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 11.5 points to close at 2,656.44, volume 130 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later, I talk with New York Times reporter Timothy Egan about the economic and environmental forces shaping the Pacific Northwest. But first, a little music. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead is up to his elbows this summer in Duke Ellington recordings. And Kevin's elbows have never been happier. He has a review of a couple of these Ellington CDs. One features this music from the soundtrack Ellington wrote for the movie Anatomy of a Murder.
Duke Ellington's music has been a good friend to me. It's just the thing to pull you back up when you're feeling low. Ellington's orchestrations are so rich and inventive, he restores your faith in human potential. He He shows us there's always something fresh we can do with the resources and the people we have to deal with. There's no sound in all of jazz, I'm tempted to say in all of music, that's as stirring as the Ellington Orchestra in full swing. That's the Ellington Band at the Newport Jazz Festival in 1959. A new CD on the Verve label, called Duke Ellington Live, presents for the first time the band's complete performance that 4th of July, Duke's stage announcements included. Like most Ellington shows of the time, it featured some old favorites for casual fans, an up-tempo romp showcasing the explosive saxophonist Paul Gonzalez, and a little new stuff for the connoisseurs. The new piece was Idiom 59, a 14-minute suite in four movements. Idiom 59 was nothing too heavy, just something Duke whipped up for a little summer entertainment. But Ellington linked together its four parts in subtle ways. The first and second movements feature solo clarinets, the first and third have Latin rhythms, and two parts have similar saxophone voicings. Besides all that, the last theme is a loose variation of the one before it, something you might miss because they're played at different tempos. I'll show you what I mean. Here's Ellington's piano intro to the third movement. Here's how he kicks off the next part. The links between those episodes are almost subliminal, but they're there if you listen for them. That sort of organization is typical of Ellington's suites. A fine new CD on the Pablo label, called the Ellington Suites, contains three of them, two recorded in the early 70s. The best of the bunch is The Queen Suite from 1959. After Ellington met England's Queen Elizabeth in 1958, he recorded the Queen Suite in her honor, had one copy pressed, and sent it to her as a present. It was a wonderfully romantic gesture from one member of royalty to another, and I can't help but wonder if the Queen ever listened to it more than once. The rest of us got to hear it only after Ellington died in 1974. There have been a few more Ellington reissues lately that I don't have time to tell you about. like an RCA disc that contains Duke's 1940 duets with bass virtuoso Jimmy Blanton. Overnight, Blanton changed everyone's ideas of how the bass could be played. But if I tried to tell you about every good Ellington record that's out, we'd never get around to anything else.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Duke Ellington live on the Verve label and the Ellington Suites from Pablo. And here's some of that Duke Ellington Jimmy Blanton duet. This is Fresh Air. Good Rain is journalist Timothy Egan's book about the Pacific Northwest. In it, he traced the trail of Theodore Winthrop, an adventurer who came to the Pacific Northwest in 1853. To cover the story, Egan hiked along the Olympic Mountains, drove through farmlands in eastern Washington, climbed the Cascades, and kayaked the waters of Puget Sound. And of course, he found a region considerably changed from Winthrop's days. When he kayaked into Seattle's Elliott Bay, Egan observed a duality he found common throughout the Northwest. He wrote, "Some say Seattle should aspire to be the Paris of Puget Sound, accepting growth with grand European style and direction, a meeting of the ideal with the inevitable. Others want to seal the city entirely, drawing a line at the forested edge and putting up the keep-out signs. What's important about Seattle, they say, is not glass and steel and money. Those are the elements of Texas, but air and light and water." Seattle is one of the cities Egan covers for the New York Times. The region is so vast, I asked him how he decides what to cover.
I break down my coverage into two general areas. The first is the resource issues. This area happens to have the world's biggest and some of its oldest trees. It used to have one of its greatest fish runs. It is one of its great agricultural centers. In the mines of the interior, it still produces a lot of the silver, lead, and gold of this country. So there are these huge resource issues, you know, what to do with these vast things that we originally scraped out of the ground and knocked down at such a terrific rate, and now most of us seem to be in love with and want to try to save them somehow. Most of these resources, by the way, are owned by the great majority of the American public. They're public resources. They're on public lands. So that's the first general area. The second has to do with the cities. I like to think that the three major cities of the Northwest, and I include Vancouver, British Columbia in that, are sort of models for the way new cities can become and remain livable. At least they like to think of themselves as that. And they like to think of themselves as a counter to the rusting and older cities of the East. So I think that there's a lot of fascination in this country and elsewhere as well, as evidenced by the some of the talks I had with people during the Goodwill Games, about how these cities are coping, developing, trying to change, trying to forge new urban ways of life.
You see the Pacific Northwest as representing a model for other ways of life. I wonder if you could elaborate on that.
Well, it's very simply this, that and this goes back to what Jefferson talked about in some of his writings about what America could be, is that there's a duality of the wild and the civilized, that you can live in the city, you can live in a place of 2 million people, and still within an hour is this perhaps illusory wild dream, the idea that you can be floating down a river that's undammed, or you can catch a salmon, or you can be atop a mountain. The Alpine Lakes Wilderness area, where there are 600 lakes, is within 45 minutes of the city of Seattle. And again, I think it may be becoming increasingly difficult to obtain this dream, but that is the Pacific Northwest ideal, that you live in this very civilized urban center, but The wild is your back door. It's just right there.
Your account, The Good Rain, is of a tour through the Pacific Northwest. It's kind of the spine of an account of life in the Northwest. Did you have to assign yourself to do this story?
No, actually, I wasn't working for the New York Times when I started this book. Midway into the research, I went to work for the Times. So I was actually inspired to follow the footsteps of the person who wrote a book in 1853, and that acts as sort of the narrative spine and inspiration for this book. So I had all these loose ends about the Northwest, and when I read this 1853 account, which was called The Canoe in the Saddle, and written by the great-great-great-grandson of the founder of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, it occurred to me that it was just a terrific thing to use as a gauge as to how the Northwest had changed.
You mentioned that you have some loose ends about the Pacific Northwest. I wonder what some of those are.
I really was curious about the place that I live on this planet and the three generations of my family that had been here. And what I found most fascinating to me, first of all, I mean, there are 27 Indian tribes in the state of Washington. The Pacific Northwest was the most densely populated area of Aboriginal Americans in what is now the lower 48. And that culture absolutely fascinated me. I had always looked at it, like a lot of people from afar, as just to being a kind of totem poles and salmon eaters. And it was only when I got out and visited some of the tribes that I saw that there is a strong strand of that culture still alive, and B, how quickly it did vanish when it was so big. I mean, there were nearly 100,000 people living at the mouths of streams along the coast of the Pacific Northwest before European contact. That is an awful lot of people. And when I started doing this research, I remember one thing in particular. This image has never left me. Being down on the Columbia River early morning and seeing a Native American out on his old plywood dip net platform trying to pull in a salmon in the way that his ancestors always had. And behind him is this huge dam sending out 1,000 megawatts of power, most of it to Los Angeles, and this river, which is utter glass, and sitting out there like almost like a museum piece, like a living museum piece, this person trying desperately to do something against the impossibilities of time and tide that his ancestors had always done. And that struck me as the ultimate Northwest image.
The Pacific Northwest is being revered, yet it's also been the site of some terrible press as well. I mean, there's a whole series of Green River murders. And I wonder for you, what is the dark side of the Pacific Northwest, not just the wintertime and the rains?
That's an interesting point. I read an interview with David Lynch recently, who, as you may know, grew up in Missoula, Montana, and parts of Spokane, and spent time in Seattle as well. And he was asked whether his television show Twin Peaks is a sort of Northwest Gothic. And he said that it is, in a sense, that he's this dark side. Of course, in Twin Peaks, it's a dark comic side, but this dark side is something he's developed. This is the edge of the continent, and maybe people, when they come here and can't fulfill their dreams, they go inward into their darker sides, and that's why you have strange crimes, serial killers. I mean, you don't have a lot of random violence, such as you have in the bigger cities of the East, but you have you had a rapist in Spokane 6-7 years ago who was the son of the managing editor of the paper, and he had raped, God knows, 30-40 women. Of course, Bundy was here. The Green River Killer stopped killing in 1984. The killings have never been solved. But maybe there is this, on an artistic level, you could call it Northwest Gothic. On a more realistic level, you could just say it's a internalization of the bleaker parts of all of us.
The plenty of the Pacific Northwest has been spent rather profligately in the past couple of years. We're seeing now the Hanford nuclear power plant is being a site of toxic wastes. Of nuclear wastes. When you fly over the Pacific Northwest, you see all the clear-cutting squares of land with the little narrow strips of trees along the side of the road so that motorists don't see that the hills are actually clear-cut. It seems that in many ways people of the Pacific Northwest have been living an illusion in the past decade or so.
There is a piece in The New Yorker about the ancient forest, and the kicker of the story was what you just mentioned, these so-called visual corridors that state law requires that you can go and absolutely devastate a mountain, denude it of trees, but you must keep this little narrow band of evergreens along the road so that the tourist driving along has no idea what's going on behind the thin veil of trees. I think that's right in large part, and that's why there's such a big fight going on over the forest right now. This part of the world is utterly polarized over what to do with the future of its forest, and that's because so much of it is gone, so little of it is left. But on the other hand, you have three huge national parks and some 5 million acres of wilderness within an hour or two of most of the cities. So the people here have at least, they're miles ahead of their countrymen in trying to save what is defining about their area. Now they're trying to save or decide what to do with that last and I think most original resource of the Pacific Northwest, these big ancient trees.
Do you have any ambivalence about lauding the Pacific Northwest as a place to live, while at the same time stressing the drawbacks of having people come there?
I think everybody who lives here, whether they're a native such as myself or somebody who's only been here 2 weeks, I seem to have talked to a lot of people this summer who decided to move here this summer. We had a fairly nice summer, unfortunately, so it drew some people here. But I think everyone who's come here, I mean, people who come here just for a week end up saying the same thing. Geez, this area is so fragile. You've got to do something to save it. You can't laud it without feeling a pang of guilt. And I do feel that. And it's very difficult. You realize that you have this wonderful thing, but on the other hand, you want to freeze it.
Well, Timothy Egan, thank you very much for coming and being a guest with us on Fresh Air today.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Timothy Egan covers the Pacific Northwest for the New York Times. His book is The Good Rain. This is Fresh Air. Later here on National Public Radio, today's edition of All Things Considered. And welcome back from vacation host Robert Siegel. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Sej. Today we'll be hearing about developments in the Persian Gulf. More Americans, Britons, and others moved from one hotel to another in Kuwait by the Iraqis. And President Bush, in his speech in Baltimore, using the word hostages to describe people who were in that very situation. We'll also be talking with our correspondent, John Itzty, who is in Saudi Arabia and who has visited the border between Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, where Saudi troops are just a few miles away, and Iraqi troops are further back from the line than we had thought. Also, the first of our series of reports on the Indian Ocean island nation of Mauritius.
Look forward to today's All Things Considered later here on National Public Radio. This week, 1 month before the official start of the new fall season, NBC is offering sneak previews of its new primetime efforts. TV critic David Bianculli explains the whys of that NBC strategy, and he gives his picks for the best and the worst of the bunch.
It all started last month when the Fox TV network announced that one of its new sitcoms, a show called Babes, would premiere August 23rd. Top-rated NBC didn't want to give Fox a one-month head start on the season, so it scheduled a sneak preview of one of its new sitcoms, Ferris Bueller, for the same night. Then, to steal the momentum from Fox, NBC added four other sneak previews the same week. After this one-shot unveiling, all five premiere episodes will be repeated in September, a scheduling gimmick that NBC calls the double pump. The funny thing, though, is that Fox's pump ran dry. Fox couldn't get Babes ready in time, so the early premiere was canceled. NBC's early premieres, though, are showing up anyway, and the best and worst of them show up tonight. The best of the early batch, in fact, NBC's best new series of the entire fall season, is a TV spin-off of the movie Parenthood. Now, I know the odds are against TV making a good series out of a good movie, MASH being the obvious and about the only exception. But Ron Howard and Brian Grazer, who produced the movie Parenthood, are producing the TV series too, and have done a good job of capturing the film's warm, yet anxiety-filled tone. The only actors reprising their movie roles are the younger kids, the ones who played Patty and Justin. But the replacements, especially for the male roles, are well chosen. The Steve Martin role goes to St. Elsewhere star Ed Begley Jr., who, as Gil, is properly flustered as he bursts into his son's class on a false alarm emergency.
I'm here.
Dad!
Mr. Buckman, is anything wrong?
Why did you call me?
I didn't. My teaching assistant called all the parents. We're going on a class trip next week, and no one will drive, and I told her to tell every parent that we needed them very badly. Oh, I'm sorry if this caused you any upset.
No. Where is this assistant?
Other stars in this large ensemble cast include William Wyndham in the Jason Robards role, Mary Edith Burrell in the Diane Wiest role, and Ken Ober, host of MTV's Remote Control, in the Rick Moranis role of the super yuppie. Ober's smart-aleck manner serves him well here, as when his character challenges the young teacher at a daycare center.
Well, why don't you hang out and...
Just a second, Miss Robin. I don't know if my wife, Miss Susan, explained our situation.
Uh-uh.
You see, I'm an educational theorist.
Uh-huh.
Which of the three forms of intelligence do you stress here? Cognitive, creative, or instrumental?
They mostly just play in the sand.
Parenthood is worth catching now. I'll catch up with the other shows during their second pump next month, but I better warn you now about tonight's Hull High, another NBC premiere. It's like Mr. Novak or Room 222 with music video inserts, or a bad version of Fame. How bad? I'll leave you with this little sample, a fantasy sequence in which Nancy Vallon, as the sexpot English teacher, sings about similes while writhing around in a red leather jumpsuit. With shows like this, one pump is plenty.
Gives language arts a whole new meaning. David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air is produced by Fred Landerol. Our engineers are Bob Alls, Ron Barron, Joyce Lieberman, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Now that we have all these labor-saving devices, why are they all so much work? On the next Fresh Air, Donald Norman explains why VCRs, toasters, and even some doors are designed so poorly. Also, Arno Penzias, the head of Bell Labs, on the future of technology. That and more next time on Fresh Air.